The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. BBRSDA, here to support your fishery.
It's time once again for the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm Mike Mason. Today we're going to check in on the recent annual meeting of the organization that represents the over 1,800 drift net permit holders in Bristol Bay. We'll also check in on the ongoing Port Moeller test fishery and get the latest escapement numbers for the King Salmon Run to the Nooshiegak River. All of that and more is coming up on today's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. This is KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. Friday was the fourth full day of fishing for the ongoing Port Moeller test fishery, which is run for 30 days in June and July, with a goal of giving fishermen and others a sense of the sockeye resource that is 6 to 9 days away from the Bristol Bay inshore fishing districts. 174 sockeye have been caught in that test fishery through Friday. 108 of those fish were taken from the 5 1/8-inch mesh, 66 sockeye from the 4 1/2-inch mesh. 49 sockeye were caught Friday, with 16 sockeye taken at both stations 4 and 6. 6 fish were taken at station 2, 5 sockeye were caught at station 8. The catch at station 10 was 6 fish. Friday's catch as part of the Port Moeller test fishery resulted in a daily replacement index number of 11 that pushed the cumulative replacement index number up to 36. Friday's daily traditional index number was 22, that pushed the cumulative index number up to 91. One of the ways the Port Moeller test fishery is used is to help determine the peak of the inshore sockeye run. To figure that out, the peak must first be determined at Port Moeller. Scott Rayburn is the man tasked with interpreting the data from the Port Moeller test fishery. He works for the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute, which runs that test fishery. He notes that Port Moeller can help determine run timing, but not this early in the season.
Port Moeller does have information regarding run timing of inshore catch and escapement. And that is, if Port Moeller is early, then catch and escapement tends to be early. If it's late, catch and escapement tends to be late. But we don't know what the run timing is at Port Moeller until catches peak and starts to decline, and then we can say with some semblance of certainty what day Port Moeller peaked. And that won't happen, typically doesn't happen until around the 28th to the 30th of June.
Last year's sockeye run to Bristol Bay was about 8 days early. That caught many fishermen off guard and not ready to fish on the early part of the run. Many observers believe this year's run also has the possibility to be early based on the warm winter and the warmer than normal sea surface temperatures. However, Scott Rayburn included data in Thursday night's interpretation that indicates a lack of a correlation between sea surface temperatures at the Port Moeller test fishery and the run timing for Bristol Bay's 5 commercial fishing districts. Sea surface temperatures have been increasing over the first 4 days of test fishing from 8 degrees Celsius Tuesday up to 8.3 degrees Celsius on Friday. Like previous years, the vessel used in the test fishery is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game research vessel Pandelis, and the fishery takes place about 250 miles from Bristol Bay. The 5 stations that are normally fished as part of that test fishery are spaced out about 10 miles apart, with the first station about 30 miles offshore from Port Moeller. Stations are basically set up on a line stretching from Port Moeller towards Cape Newenham. The net used in the fishery is a 200-fathom gill net with alternating 50-fathom shackles of 5 1/8-inch mesh and 4 1/2-inch mesh. That net has been used since 2011. Before that, the net used in the fishery was made up entirely of 5 1/8-inch mesh. The first genetic stock composition estimates from the fishery are scheduled to be released by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game around June 20th. Scott Rayburn is excited that it's time to once again go fishing in Bristol Bay. He hopes the Port Moeller test fishery can provide some useful data for fishermen, managers, and processors.
I'd like to wish everybody good luck this year, and we will do our best to give you the best decision support we can provide.
The daily catch data, interpretations, and other reports from the Port Moeller test fishery can be found online on the website of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. The test fishery is scheduled to run through July 10th. This is KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report was made possible in part by AIFMA, the Alaska Independent Fishermen's Marketing Association, representing fishermen since 1966. More information at AIFMA.org.
Bristol Bay's largest king salmon run is the run to the Nooshigak River, and that run continues to show up in strength early in the season. Another 1,900 kings were counted as escapement on Friday, pushing the season total up to 16,200. Friday was the fifth straight day of escapements topping 1,800. That means the run is on track to reach the escapement goal of 95,000 kings in river. Tim Sands is the area management biologist for the Alaska Division of Commercial Fisheries. He says the escapement numbers continue to look good.
Doesn't seem like there's a lot being caught on the beaches. I'm hearing a few here and there. So, of course, we haven't had really a lot of wind either to push them up on the beach. But we're certainly pleased with where we're at.
The good escapement numbers for kings allowed the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to allow a one-day directed king salmon opening on Friday for commercial fishermen in the Nooshigak District. Harvest numbers are not yet available, but KDLG News has heard anecdotal accounts from fishermen that fishing was slow and that fishermen only caught a handful of kings. One of the priorities of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in recent years has been to get fishermen to actually record the kings they catch, whether that is in directed king openings or when they catch kings incidentally in the sockeye fishery. Sand says kings can be recorded directly on a fish ticket.
If you go out there and you only catch a couple and you're going to take them all home, then come into the office and we'll imprint your card and do a personal use fish ticket for you. If you catch a bunch and you're taking a couple home, when you deliver it to tender, say you're taking a couple home, and the tenderman can write it down on the fish ticket under the personal use box.
In recent years, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has been stressing the requirement to record kings caught in Bristol Bay in an effort to fill in some of the gaps in the data about the king salmon runs in the region. Sand says an accurate count is very helpful.
All our brood tables, everything we use for forecasting and everything with the run, setting the escapement goals, all that is all based on having good data. And that data is how many fish return off of each year's brood year. So that's what we're trying to get.
Last year, about 19,000 king salmon were harvested in Bristol Bay. Vast majority of those fish were taken incidentally in the sockeye fishery. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has stopped producing an actual forecast for the king salmon run to the Nooshigak River, which is the largest king run in the Bristol Bay region. Instead, the department has been producing a king salmon harvest projection. This year's projection anticipates a commercial king salmon harvest in Bristol Bay of about 21,000 fish. The escapement goal for the Nooshigak king salmon run is 95,000 fish. Sands confirms escapement is still about 7 days ahead of the historical curve used by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to make management decisions. King salmon escapement to the Nooshigak River is counted at the sonar counting site that's set up near Portage Creek. The main purpose of the sonar counting operation is to count sockeye salmon to the Nooshigak River. Through Friday, total count was over 6,800. 2,200 sockeye were counted Friday. Sands confirms that sockeye escapement is ahead of the historical curve. The escapement goal for the Nooshigak River is 370,000 to 840,000 sockeye. The other species counted at the Nooshigak River sonar counter is chum salmon, and over 4,500 chums were counted Thursday, pushing the season total to just over 43,000 fish. The other enumeration project up and running in the Nooshigak District is the Wood River. The tower started counting Friday, and the daily count was just 840 sockeye on Friday. The Agushik River towers should be operational on June 24th. Over in the Togiak District, the counting towers on the Togiak River are expected to be up and running by July the 3rd. You're listening to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. We'll be back in one moment. Thank you.
Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Crawley, fueling Alaska for more than 60 years with a full range of residential, commercial, aviation, and marine fuel products, and supporting local fisheries offshore with Bristol Bay Floater Fueling Services. More information at CrawleyFuels.com.
This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report here on listener-supported public radio, KDLG. I'm Mike Mason. Bristol Bay's massive sockeye fishery is slowly gearing up as more and more fishermen and processors show up every day. Last year's early run has resulted in speculation that this year's run will also be very early. However, that is not yet supported by the data, but the data is still quite limited. It appears there is a large drift fleet already in the Igigik district, but there doesn't appear to be a lot of fish around. Fishing Game still can't disclose exact harvest numbers, but the total from Igigik is about 16,000 thus far this season. Weekly fishing schedule ended in the district at 9 a.m. Friday morning, but Fishing Game has announced both set and drift periods in the district for Monday. Set netters get to fish from 2:15 until 10:15 on Monday, and drifters get a four-hour period Monday from 2:30 p.m. until 6:30 p.m. Paul Solomon is the ADF&G Area Management Biologist for the Igigik District.
If I open something in Igigik, everybody's going to go there from other districts, and I figure I might as well just get it out of the way and keep people there to begin with, because last year when we did something, we had guys running from Naknek down there with fish are still on board, which is not something we want. So by announcing on Monday, they'll stay there and won't have that problem.
Tracking the commercial fishing fleet across much of Bristol Bay is difficult so early in the season because fishermen don't have to register until June the 25th if they fish in the Eastside districts. However, Solomon believes there is a significant drift fleet already on the fishing grounds in the Igigik district.
Well, I haven't had a whole lot of guys fishing, but my reports are that there's a couple of hundred, maybe as many as 300 boats already there. Not all of them are fishing. Many of them are sitting around waiting for something to happen. But those that are fishing are doing, progressively a little better every day. Nothing to write home about.
Solomon confirms the test fishing crew is in the process of deploying. He anticipates they will be up and running by Monday. The Fishing Game forecast for the Igigik District is 4.65 million sockeye. The escapement goal for the Igigik River is between 800,000 to 1.4 million fish. Solomon is also the area management biologist for the Ugashik District. He's leaving the district closed through the weekend after the weekly fishing schedule ended Friday morning.
I'm going to keep it closed probably until I see something worth fishing on, but I'm not going to let the drifters go like we did last year. I just got the genetics from my guys in town. I can't divulge them because I'm not sure I can release them, but there's, like people suspected, there's a lot of fish that don't belong there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit and watch it for a while, and any openings in the near future are likely to be set net only for a little while.
The counting towers on the Ugashik River are expected to be up and running on June 27th. Solomon is characterizing the commercial harvest in the Ugashik District so far this season as about 4,000 sockeye total. Solomon confirms that Fishing Game can't yet release the exact harvest data for both the Igigik and Ugashik districts.
Our criteria is set up so that you can't assign it to either an individual or a processor. So we have to have three or more processors or three or more fishermen. So unless I meet both of those criteria, I can't do anything with it. So I might have three fishermen scattered across three processors, but that's typically not the case.
Commercial fishermen in both districts are asked to stand by at 12 noon Monday for the next possible announcement about fishing time in the Igigik and Ugashik districts. The other Eastside district that fishermen can fish in without having to register until June the 25th is the Naknek-Quijack district, which is under the direction of new area management biologist Travis Ellison. He's excited about the first season in Bristol Bay.
Awesome fishery, and we've got lots of great assessment, lots of harvest power, and generally have a lot of fish. So it's kind of a manager's dream job as long as the fish show up. So I'm excited for it. I think it'll go well. Slim Morstad's sticking around through most of the season to help give me advice, and I'm happy for that. Hope to learn a lot from him. I already have. And so, yeah, looking forward to a good season.
Fishing Game's confidentiality restrictions still apply in the Naknek-Quijack district, so Ellison couldn't disclose the harvest in the district. He said it wasn't much. Ellison characterized the commercial fishing efforts so far this season in the district as small.
Yeah, there's really nothing to report from Naknek-Quijack yet. So as expected for this week. I mean, we're expecting participation and harvest to really kick off next week.
The Naknek River counting towers were expected to be operational on Saturday, and the Quijack towers should be operational by Monday. Both enumeration projects are going in 5 days earlier than normal, thanks to funding from the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, which represents the over 1,800 DriftNet permit holders. Despite the lack of fish, there is fishing time in the Naknek-Quijack District. The district set netters can fish all week from 9 a.m. Monday until 9 a.m. Friday. The drifters have already announced fishing periods every day next week. The mesh restriction in the district is 5.5 inches or less until July the 20th. The regular announcement times this season for all of the fishing districts in Bristol Bay will be 9 a.m., 12 noon, 3 p.m., 6 p.m., and 8 p.m. Those announcements will be broadcast by Fish and Game on VHF Channel 7A, and KDLG will broadcast the announcements at the regular announcement times until the end of the season. Fish and Game notes that information is also available via the telephone. For the Eastside districts, you can call 246-4636. For the Westside districts, call 842-5226. The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report will continue in a moment.
Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is made possible in part by Naknek Family Fisheries, 246-FISH, or on the web at naknekfish.com.
The annual meeting of the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association was held on June 7th in Naknek. Between 20 to 30 of the over 1,800 DriftNet permit holders that the organization represents actually turned out at the Bristol Bay Borough School to hear about how the RSDA is trying to help market the sockeye caught each summer in Bristol Bay and how the organization is fighting development of the proposed Pebble Mine. Another initiative of the organization is to spur fishermen to use chilling as a way to improve the quality of their catch. The quality committee included board members Fritz Johnson from Dillingham and Matt Marinkovich from Friday Harbor, Washington, as well as commercial fishermen David Harsela and Buck Gibbons. Fritz Johnson noted that the BBRSDA is providing up to $18,000 for a project to test a new ice bag delivery system in the bay.
It's an insulated ice bag that three companies have agreed to purchase samples of. This is it's like a slush bag with insulation, but big enough to hold roughly 1,000 pounds of ice. The idea being that if tenders are delivering ice to where people are fishing, this is more helpful to guy rather than having to run to Clark's Point or back into the river in Naknek, you know, to collect ice, or to carry around a hard-sided tote on either tenders or your fishing boat. You empty the bag; it's flexible, it folds up, and it's not cumbersome on deck.
30 of the new bags will be tested this year. Ocean Beauty Seafoods will apparently test 10 of them. New RSDA Executive Director Sue Asplund reported that Ocean Beauty's already put the bags to the test.
They had dry tested them down in their Seattle plant, and they still had ice in them after 5 days. They drug them around the parking lot, tried to beat them up, and they did beat them up pretty good, but he felt like they subjected them to stuff that they're probably not, conditions they're not going to see out. And so he's pretty optimistic about them, and I haven't had a chance to connect with the other processors yet.
The stipulations of the ice bag project requires the processors to provide the RSDA with a report about how the ice bags performed before the processors can be reimbursed for the cost associated with the project. Improving the quality of the catch in Bristol Bay has been the number one priority of the BBRSDA, and Johnson noted that over $800,000 has been spent on projects to improve quality since 2009.
Through better handling, does a round haul work better than picking on the reel? A lot of stuff that's really kind of common sense, but without quantifying that, those kinds of handling practices, it's difficult to say to a processor that, hey, this is going to earn you more money than a fisherman more money than some more traditional ways of fishing.
By all accounts, there have been great strides in improving the quality of the catch in Bristol Bay in recent years. More and more fishermen are utilizing refrigerated seawater systems, and back in 2012, the DriftNet fleet chilled nearly 60% of their catch. Johnson believes that the emphasis on quality by many fishermen and processors could be a contributing factor to the recent increases in the price that Bristol Bay fishermen have been getting for their catch.
Today, people are talking about $2. Is that solely because we're delivering better fish these days? I think that would be a gross overassumption, but I hope it's made a difference, because what if we hadn't done that, you know? Where would we be today?
Another contributing factor to the recent price increases in Bristol Bay might be the growing popularity of the sockeye products that come out of the bay. That's where marketing comes into play. And another major priority of the RSDA Board of Directors is to better market Bristol Bay as a brand, much like Copper River salmon are considered a well-known brand. RSDA board member Matt Luck from Ketchum, Idaho. He's the captain of the Meg J. He sits on the RSDA's marketing committee. He admits that the organization's marketing efforts have changed substantially the last couple of years, with less reliance on third-party contractors and a greater emphasis on conducting the marketing initiatives in-house. Luck says the long-term goal is to raise consumer awareness about Bristol Bay's tremendous sockeye resource. He notes that the new marketing plan basically sets up the RSDA to function as a trade organization.
We have a product that we produce 65% on an average annual basis of all the wild sockeye salmon in the world. And every commodity producer, whether it's pork, beef, milk, whatever it is, they're organizations that represent the industry as a whole and are advocates for the industry. And like I said, talk about and spread the word on a global basis of the health and nutritional benefits. And those are the kind of things that the RSDA can do. You know, as me and many of our Bristol Bay processors don't like to call out Bristol Bay in the context of their marketing programs. Many of them buy fish in Prince William Sound and Southeast Alaska and Kodiak, and they find that addressing that product as wild Alaska sockeye gives them more flexibility. Well, we believe that there's some real potential value in regional branding.
Luck noted that name recognition of Copper River salmon, and he says that the RSDA's goal is to use the Copper River model as a way to market Bristol Bay salmon.
So one of the things we're doing is looking, looking for partners that are willing to call that out and will find some value in identifying product with the producers and with the region. Pebble Mine's done a lot to give a lot of notice on a national basis to what we have here in Bristol Bay. So Elizabeth's put together a program with the Google campuses in Palo Alto, where Bristol Bay sockeye will be on the menu at the Google campus to thousands of employees over the course of the summer. And it's those kind of little things that start to build people's understanding of what this resource is and what Bristol Bay wild salmon can contribute to a consumer-based protein source all over the country.
The BBRSDA has been putting funding towards several marketing programs in recent years. The organization funded the development of materials that can be used by the growing number of direct marketers in the Bay. Many of those materials are available directly on the BBRSDA website. This year, the organization is spending $64,000 with the McDowell Group to produce biannual research reports on the Bristol Bay sockeye markets, as well as distribution channels. Matt Luck believes the RSDA is making better use of the money given the organization by DriftNet Fishermen by bringing the marketing program in-house as opposed to relying solely on third-party contractors.
We all contribute 1% of our gross income to this, and you all contribute 1% of your gross income to this. And we're really looking for ways that we get the best investment for every dollar we spend. Contracting out marketing work to a sheet of mire wasn't the most effective way to take those dollars and get the most back from it. We really look at this as a return on investment. And trying to develop these programs that actually create and are going to, that we as fishermen are going to be able to capture some of that value somewhere down the road. Value that's created by the work that we propose and carry forward is really an important part of our discussion every day. And I just think everybody should know that.
Towards the end of his presentation, Luck announced that in mid-July, the RSDA will be sponsoring a press tour of the Bristol Bay region for food writers, authors, journalists, and others to see the Bristol Bay fishery up close and personal. He says that tour will also include a representative from the Wegmans grocery store chain, which has stores up and down the east coast of the United States.
They want to come and see Bristol Bay, and they want to call out Bristol Bay in all of their stores, and all of their fresh sushi product in Wegmans stores, in all of their entire national chain, they want to use and call out Bristol Bay sockeye. This is the kind of thing that we start to see get developed when we start to do this in-house and things don't get bounced off in Asmere. Schiedemeyer doesn't get a call, but we have one person that's the point of contact for the Regional Seafood Development Association. And it's very similar to what other regional associations do.
The annual meeting of the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association was held on Saturday, June the 7th in Naknek. The RSDA was created in 2006 when the DriftNet permit holders in the Bay voted to assess 1% of their harvest to support the work of the organization. The Alaska Local Boundary Commission met Wednesday regarding the recent decision by the Superior Court judge in Dillingham overturning the City of Dillingham's annexation of the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District. KDLG's Chase Cavanaugh listened in on the meeting and filed this report.
In 2010, the City of Dillingham filed a petition to annex 396 square miles of Nooshigak Bay. This area constitutes the Nooshigak Fishing District and is the only one not under the control of a city or municipality. By annexing this area, Dillingham hopes to profit from the abundant fishing in the area, specifically by imposing a 2.5% fishing tax. It hopes to use the tax to pay for various city projects and services. Alaska's Local Boundary Commission approved the city's petition in late 2011, and it was ratified by Dillingham's populace in April 2012. However, 2 months before the vote, the village of Eekuk filed an appeal. They claimed that a local vote only let residents of Dillingham voice their opinions on the issue, while leaving out outlying native villages. Alaska's Superior Court agreed, with Judge Patricia Douglas overturning it. LBC local government specialist Brent Williams says the petition now goes back to the commission.
So the court gave it back, the petition back to the LBC, and ordered the commission to direct the City of Dillingham to refile the petition as a legislative review petition.
That was the purpose of Wednesday's meeting of the Local Boundary Commission. The commissioners worked to pass a resolution that would direct Dillingham to refile its petition with the requirements necessary for legislative review. There was no discussion of the petition's economic aspects, such as the fish tax and its effects on fishermen, but City Attorney Brooks Chandler expressed concerns about the resolution's language.
My concern is simply that the whereas clause could be read to commit the commission to reconsider the substantive standards for annexation that have already been gone through and resulted in a written decision, as opposed to considering whether the city has properly held the pre-filing hearing that the court required. And I wouldn't want that decision to be made months before a petition had actually crossed the threshold of the commission after the public hearing.
The language in dispute was the last whereas of the resolution, which told Dillingham to start the petition process anew and follow the normal steps for a legislative review petition provided for in statute and regulation, including the technical review procedures, opportunity for written public comments, LBC staff reports, and an LBC public hearing. A discussion was raised on whether to delete this language, with Chandler supporting it. Others wanted clarification, including Commissioner Daryl Hargraves.
Quite frankly, I didn't see in it the need to start anew. It seems like Chandler's position is that somehow we can avoid going back to the beginning. So my first question is, does this resolution we're proposing, does this take us back to the start of the process and have to come up through the hearings and everything just like it was a new petition? Can somebody answer that?
Assistant Attorney General Margie Van Dore attempted to clarify the matter.
It seems on several places that it talks about that, you know, the court vacated the annexation that was done, and then it remanded to the commission to process the petition by legislative review. And, you know, it just seems that the reason that she's doing that is because there was no pre-hearing. But at the pre-hearing, that is a substantive process, a procedural process. And she acknowledges that things may change by the time the petition is filed.
Debate followed, mostly considering on whether changing regulations meant Dillingham would have to start the petition process over completely, or have specific conditions under which it was able to file the petition revisited. Despite Chandler's concerns, the resolution passed as written, with the commissioner saying that concerns about substantive standards could be brought up with the court either before or during the pre-submission hearing. Van Dorr, however, said that if it was up to her, she would still go through the whole process.
I think personally, under the normal due process that legislative review petitions have, that, in my opinion, is probably the safer route to take here, rather than cut corners. But if we have a court who's going to say, you know, no, I really just said, you know, do the pre-file, and if the petition doesn't change, then the LBC does not need to do all of the procedural processes that are set out. I will let a court do that, but I wouldn't advise that.
The pre-filing hearing is the next step in the process and is scheduled to take place in September. If it passes that step, Brent Williams says it will continue along the path for legislative review.
The second one will go to the legislature if the LBC approves the petition the second time around, and then it would go to the legislature in the first 10 days of a regular session, and the legislature would have 45 days to disapprove it.
Meeting minutes, comments, and a copy of the resolution are available at the LBC's website. From Dillingham, I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
A new film about the people that make up the Bristol Bay fishing industry has been making the rounds of film festivals across the country. KDLG's Luke Brummer reports.
Elijah Lawson is like many other Bristol Bay fishermen in that he was born into it. His father operated a boat during the sockeye salmon season for many years. As soon as Lawson was old enough, his dad had him helping out to experience commercial fishing firsthand. Lawson is now a documentary filmmaker based in Seattle. Earlier this year, he produced and directed a new 21-minute documentary film titled In the Same Boat, which focuses on multi-generational families that fish together in Bristol Bay.
The inspiration from this film came from the years that I spent on a boat, growing up fishing, learning how to work hard, learning what it's like to catch this sustainable resource, and the importance of it to people around the world, the food source that it is.
The film is actually made up of three shorter films, which Lawson made after receiving a grant from the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. The smaller films were produced to play separately, but Lawson later tied them together in order to enter several film festivals. The film played at the Seattle International Film Festival in late May to a sold-out crowd. It opened for The Breach, a film focusing on industries endangering salmon populations in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. He said the proposed pebble mine in Bristol Bay is not mentioned directly in his film, but rather it addresses it indirectly by showing the stories of Bristol Bay fishermen.
Both films were about fishing. The second film really covered pebble mine. And although my film isn't outright an anti-pebble mine film, because I never really talked to anyone in the film about the mine, it's very much an anti-pebble mine film because we are trying to educate people to what we do up here. And I'm trying to tell stories about individuals, and people connect with those stories more than they would somebody saying, you know, oh, the pebble mine isn't good because of this reason, that reason, that reason. Those films have already been made.
Lawson said the filming process was not an easy feat due to unforeseen interviews falling through, filming on rough waters, and the fact that he still planned to carry on fishing throughout the summer season.
I think the most challenging part of this whole project, and actually when I look back, it's hard to believe that I was able to make a film and get my boat ready and actually go fishing. Last year was also a unique year. The fish came very early, so I was filming people getting their boats ready, knowing my boat wasn't ready yet. So a little stressful, but, you know, it was worth it because the projects really came together well.
He said that the Alaska landscape and lighting made it easier to gather the required shots for the film.
One of the best parts about filming in Alaska is that you have what we call golden hour for, you know, 5 hours. The light is so beautiful from 8 p.m. until 1 a.m. We would often shoot those hours just to get the best lighting. And fortunately, there's so much beautiful scenics and beautiful areas to shoot up here that we got lucky.
Lawson follows the motto, show it, don't say it. And he said he brought that to this film with the use of images, and the film is guided by the interviewees rather than a voiced-over narration.
I wanted this to feel like a story or a poem, or as if the tide goes in and tide goes out. It has a definite feel to it. I really wanted to show this beautiful place where we actually work together to collect and harvest this resource.
The film has been entered into 12 different festivals internationally, and Lawson plans to extend that to 10 more. The film will play locally at Fishtival and Neck Neck later in July. In Dillingham, I'm Luke Brummer.
This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report on listener-supported public radio, KDLG. The U.S. Coast Guard is trying to get Bristol Bay fishermen ready for a safe season by offering free fishing vessel safety inspections through about June 19th. Coast Guard inspectors are currently in the Dillingham, Igigik, and Naknek King Salmon areas. Petty Officer Steve Skeen has been coming out to Bristol Bay each summer for the last 4 years to conduct the free voluntary safety inspections of vessels. He says the number one issue he sees is expired flares.
Everybody forgets to check those dates. They're good for about 3 years, but sometimes the stores sell them when they've already been sitting there a year or two.
Petty Officer Skeen says the inspections cover the basics.
Navigation and life-saving primarily. So your immersion suits, the life buoy, radios, the lights, basic electronics, and firefighting.
The Coast Guard safety exams are totally voluntary, and there are no penalties for not having the proper safety equipment on board. However, vessels that can't pass the inspection won't be able to post the standard Coast Guard decal. Petty Officer Skeen is asking fishermen to help the Coast Guard officers ensure a quick and thorough inspection.
The most helpful thing is somebody that knows where everything is. If the captain's there, that's the best. He knows his boat, but sometimes there's just a deckhand, and we spend a lot of time looking for paperwork or looking for where stuff is stowed.
A list of vessels ready for inspection in the Dillingham area is being kept at the Dillingham Harbor Master's office, and you can get your name on the list by calling 842-1069. Petty Officer Skeen is asking you leave detailed contact information and directions to your vessel, especially if it's located outside of the established boatyards. Inspectors are also in the Naknek King Salmon area, and fishermen in area boatyards are asked to let the Coast Guard know they're ready for an inspection by hanging a life ring up high in the vessel's mast. The Coast Guard inspectors are scheduled to be in the region through about June 19th. That concludes today's edition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. As always, if you have something to add to our fisheries coverage, please send me an email to mike@kdlg.org. You can also call KDLG at 842-5281. The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report can be heard each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 4 p.m. through the end of July right here on listener-supported public radio, KDLG. Until next time, please be safe, watch the weather, and stay tuned to KDLG.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. BBRSDA, here to support your fishery.